In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
The president and his party celebrated the 4th of July with the signing of an omnibus bill. What does it mean for South Dakota? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, July 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, our Dakota political junkies unpack what's in the one big, beautiful bill. It takes big strides towards implementing President Trump's campaign promises and domestic agenda, but where are the compromises? Then Mike Thompson looks at recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. We'll explore the relationship between the federal district courts and the presidency. Plus, the Project Prison Reset Task Force has 14 ideas for the new prison facility. SDPB's Jackson Dirks brings us a recap of his conversation with Lieutenant Governor Tony Vanhuizen. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Project Prison Reset held its fourth meeting this week. The task force, chaired by Lieutenant Governor Tony Vanhuizen, discussed new site submissions. And SDPB's Jackson Dirks was there for the meeting. He is seated here in the Kirby Family Studio with an update.
Thanks, Lori.
So this was in Sioux Falls at the Alliance?
Yeah, it was the Military Heritage Alliance, yes.
Okay, so help me understand the goals of this. How did they start things out saying what they were trying to accomplish Tuesday?
To start, you have to look back at, obviously, there was a Lincoln County site, and the legislature was trying to pass a bill to get a prison on that Lincoln County site for $825 million. That was denied. So then Governor Roden created this task force, Project Prison Reset Task Force, and basically he gave them three questions. The first one, does the state need a new prison? The answer was unanimously, yes, we do. The second question then was what should be built, like how many beds, should there be rehabilitative services and other things like that? And the third question, where should be built? So we've had the answer to the first one for a while. Now, this was sort of the last chance to get answers to those two questions of where and what should be built as a prison in South Dakota.
All right, so help me understand how many people are in the room. A lot of public input this time, or is that stage over?
To begin, there was a lot of people in the room, I'd say. The whole room was completely filled out. We had a lot of people there from Mitchell and Worthing, sort of towards the beginning, like right before lunch. The meeting started at 9, so right about lunchtime, the task force voted to get rid of the Mitchell site and the Worthing site. They got rid of those, and then it was really not that many people. I'd say, like, myself included, excluding the task force, like 30 people in the building then.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened then. And once we take Mitchell and Worthing off the table, what's left to be decided?
Essentially, we entered the meeting. There were, I believe, 14 proposals on the table, including Mitchell and Worthing. You take those away, I think we were down to three.
Okay.
With, they're calling it the Sweetman site. That's just who's offering up the land. Sure. And so then there's another site called the Benson property. And so it's just along Benson Road.
Okay.
And so essentially, there's these two sites. The proposals that were for the Sweetman site can also go on the Benson. So that was the first thing that was decided, is we are doing it in Sioux Falls. Where is going to be up to the legislature, essentially. There's not necessarily a preference one or the other.
They narrowed down the where.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So the where.
We still have to deal with the what. And then there is the how much.
Yes.
So tell me about the what and the conversations around what they could build and how much it would cost.
Yes, that is the bulk of the
dicey
meeting.
Yeah.
Yes, that's
all
where
right
we get a lot of contention. So the what, they're the people who gave the proposals, J.E. Dunn, they gave a range of like 1,200 beds to 1,500. So if you remember back when they had the most recent meeting, they suggested there should be a 1,500 to 1,700 bed prison. That was sort of the minimum for what South Dakota's projected over the next 100 years, since it's a 100-year building. That's what the target goal has been. So there was a lot of discussion of, should it be a 100-year prison? I mean, we could do it a lot cheaper for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, so then essentially you're going to have to rebuild the whole thing in 50 years. The legislature talked, and it seems like the appetite for that is they don't really want that. They want to stick with this 100-year prison. Then the question is, how many beds? 1,500 is the minimum, is essentially what was suggested and recommended. That 1,500 bed was sort of a sticking point because some people said, well, we could do 1,200 beds now. And then maybe once we have some of these new laws go into place to hopefully address the recidivism and other things, maybe 1,200 beds, then we add on if we need it. Secretary Wasco said essentially if they built 1,200 beds, it would still be above 100% capacity. So there was a lot of discussion. Then it got to the price, and that's a whole another thing to unpack. Yeah. So I think the cheapest price that J.E. Dunn gave was $622 million. The goal was $600 million. That's what the legislature had asked. That's the max the project could cost, right, is $622 million for that lowest one. Then the discussion became, well, how much do we want to pay? If they're saying $622 million, we only want $600 million.
All right. So there's some tense moments there. Was there a moment where you thought, this is all going to fall apart?
Yes, there was. We come out of a long lunch break, and I actually was feeling pretty confident that it seemed like things were heading in one direction. Then Lieutenant Governor Tony Van Huysen opened the floor, and Representative Jameson was the first person to speak, and he essentially said, a lot of people don't trust these numbers. So for context, there had been discussions of these other states' prisons that were cheaper, much cheaper. So, for example, Nebraska has a prison that's a little over $300 million. That's what they're building. Now, it's not a direct comparison. There's a lot of things in the South Dakota prison that aren't in Nebraska, but they said a lot of the legislatures are seeing that number, and they think, why is our number so much higher? I mean, ours is more, almost double. So there were a lot of questions of, are we getting the best deal? That seems to be where the contentious point is should this bidding process be opened? The first time the bid was opened, there was only one bidder. It was J.E. Dunn. Yeah. So the only person who agreed to do it. And essentially, the legislature, after a lot of talk, decided that we should at least stick with J.E. Dunn because they've done years of work.
But there was almost a go back to the drawing board moment.
Yes, there was. I think the words were reset of the reset.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
But they did not do that.
You also heard a little bit from the Sioux Falls contingent saying, we're going to be the where. We understand that. However, don't forget this moment that Sioux Falls is the where. Tell me about that.
There was a lot of talk of that. Senator Jamie Smith, Sheriff Milstead, just the conversation was, it's easy to do something now and put a prison in Sioux Falls, but the issue is, how does that affect the community? How does that affect everyone else and sort of like paying for this? So obviously the state funds the prison and does stuff, but some of these rehabilitative services come from the community. That's who's supporting these people. People on probation, some of that comes from the community. If there's an increase in crime, that's up to the county and that's up to the Sioux Falls Police Department to sort of help with that. And so Sheriff Milstead, actually, he had an interesting comment just about how they're already addressing property tax, which is going to directly affect the police department and the county sheriff's department and stuff. And he said, well, we're already seeing cuts now. Like, why would I support something if I don't know there's funding secured? So he said he supports the project. He understands it. But he wants them to secure future funding now for the area because it's going to come with costs. And
so what was decided at the end of the day?
Yeah, at the end of the day, a 1,500-bed prison, a $650 million cap. They're asking J.E. Dunn to come with something under that. If it's under it, great, but there's a cap of $650 million. They don't want these rehabilitative services to be cut. They want those to stay intact. So it's just going to be where does the
leeway. So now we wait for J.E. Dunn to say, yes, we can give you this for a cap of $650 million and give you everything that you want. So what, I guess my question is, what happens next?
The immediate now is we wait for Governor Roden. He got this recommendation, that's to him, and then he's going to call a special session. Then there will be parameters around that. The legislature then in both chambers has to approve the project by 2/3 because of that financial piece. And that's going to be where I think we're going to see more drama or just more more contention because there
more
are a lot
political
of
political intrigue.
More political intrigue, yes. That's where we're going to see people having these discussions again, I'm sure, just of, can we trust this figure? What's to be expected? Okay. And so 2/3 is what's required to get it passed in both chambers.
That's SDPB's Jackson Dirks. Find his work on this developing story on our website, sdpb.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. On the 4th of July, President Donald Trump signed what he calls the One Big Beautiful Bill into law. It's a law that reshapes federal policy and implements the president's domestic agenda. Our Dakota political junkies join us now to dive into what it means for South Dakota. Dr. Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University. She joined us from SDPB's Janine Basinger Studios in Brookings. Dr. David Wilsey is professor of political science, also at SDSU. He joined us today via Zoom. The size and scope of it, what context do we need to understand before we really start talking about what's in it?
I would say just the fact that there are a variety of different items in this particular bill, which of course then makes it an omnibus piece of legislation, and then how this is President Trump's domestic agenda, at least as of right now, which is really focused on trying to deliver on his campaign promises relating to cutting government spending.
So Dave Wilsey, promises made, but some promises broken, because the president also said he would not be cutting Medicaid, or many Republicans said they wouldn't, and yet they are now.
Well, that's the legislative process. I mean, obviously, when you're campaigning, and when you're campaigning as someone who's not terribly policy specific or savvy, like President Trump is most of the time, you know, legislative realities are going to, you know, hit you once you start negotiating with people in Congress. So it's not at all surprising that, you know, some of these things like Medicaid, Medicare, and the like are going to be dialed back a little bit in terms of the promises. But, you know, getting back to this whole omnibus thing, I mean, we've made this shift, and Lisa can probably tell you more about this than I as a congressional scholar, but since the 90s, early 2000s, we've seen a change towards a lot of these really big bills, but we're getting to a point where you have to spend so much political capital to get something through Congress that you are going to stuff every possible thing that you can in the legislation. And that's exactly what they tried to do here. And some of it got dialed back once it ran into issues with the Senate parliamentarian because of rules on appropriation and whether you can be subject or not to a filibuster. But that's the reality of it. It's a negotiation process. And the president in the end probably got a lot more than he wanted than we didn't want out of it.
Yeah. Lisa, what do we need to understand about reconciliation as a process? Is it worth understanding how it works, because it's going to be a thing that we'll be revisiting a lot in the future? Or are we going to be looking back and going, remember that one time when they, you know, did this big thing through the reconciliation process? Because this is the first time I've heard of it, and, you know, that probably either means I wasn't paying attention to that aspect, or it means it got a lot more attention than it has in the past.
I think it just speaks to this larger trend where we're seeing a variety of things happening that we're maybe not used to. And some of this does go back to what Dave was talking about, where we do try to have these larger pieces of legislation where we're packing a lot into them, or where we're trying to use different processes in order to accomplish certain political goals. So we see this a lot too when we're looking at other budget-oriented legislation, where we see a lot of things trying to go in them, and then throughout the course of the policymaking process, moving from the two chambers, you start to see things kind of coming out along the way. Also kind of getting to what Dave was talking about, just the policymaking process in general, where you may think that you're going to be able to get something, but then at the end of the day, you don't necessarily end up getting that accomplished because you have all these members of Congress having a say at the end of the day.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what's in it and how what's in it will impact South Dakotans. Dr. Wilsey, where do you want to begin with something that is in this bill that will have an impact on many South Dakotans?
The first thing I would mention here is rural health care. One of the realities of rural health care in this country is our rural areas are much more dependent upon Medicaid than urban and suburban areas. So the cuts that we're going to be seeing by trimming back eligibility requirements, ramping up work requirements and the like, they're going to disproportionately hit rural areas, and South Dakota will be no exception to this. The CBO, which kind of gives a score on the budget ramifications of any given piece of legislation, estimated that about $150 billion will be cut from rural areas over the next 10 years because of these rule and eligibility changes. Now, one of the things that happened in the Senate, which ramped up the costs of the Senate bill, was a $50 billion offset was negotiated, spearheaded largely by Senator Murkowski of Alaska. But that's only going to partly cover it. Mm-hmm. So in the end, what this is going to mean is a lot of people in rural areas are going to find themselves out of coverage 2-3 years down the line. This is going to have a spillover effect on our rural hospitals because they are very dependent on Medicaid patients. And if they lose those patients, they'll be losing that funding. So we already have a crisis in South Dakota and other rural areas in our healthcare delivery, and this is just going to exacerbate it.
Yeah, help me understand, Dr. Hager, why rural areas are more dependent upon Medicaid. Dave touched on a little bit there, but what else can you spin out to so people understand why is that happening? What is the nature of rural America that's connecting with that?
So as far as Medicaid patients, you know, typically you're going to be finding those folks who are low income on Medicaid, but also those people who have become disabled in some shape or form. And so I think then the question becomes, you know, what sorts of work opportunities are available in some of these areas if they are those who are deemed able to work under this new piece of legislation? And if they're not, you know, are they then just ultimately losing care? And then are they trying to seek care at these rural facilities without health insurance, which just drives up the cost for these different providers to provide health care to these individuals? And then also just the fact that, you know, that drives up costs for everyone. So I think sometimes the impact of what that actually looks like remains to be seen, but typically mm-hmm. when we see folks losing care, they're not always able to secure health insurance elsewhere, so it just ends up being more costly for these providers to provide them the care when they are actually seeking it.
I see.
And let's be very clear on this. You know, we're talking about people who, for the most part, are working, the working poor. And in rural areas, South Dakota and other places in the Midwest, you've got a lot of folks who are dependent upon Medicaid in some way, shape, or form, who are employed. They might not be fully employed. They could be partially employed. They could lose eligibility because of that or for any other number of reasons through these rule changes. So this is not just something that's going to affect those who are out of work and those who are on the dole, so to speak.
All right. Okay. So rural health care, will be watching the implications of that. We know that voters approved a measure here in South Dakota to allow state lawmakers to impose their own work requirements, but we have a pretty high labor force participation already. We just learned that from Joe Santos and earlier this week. So I guess I'm just trying to get my mind around the concept that people on Medicaid are not working, but yet we know the numbers in South Dakota that suggest we have very high employment and relatively high labor participation. Who does that leave? How do we measure the outcomes of this in rural South Dakota is really my big question. Help me understand this.
Some of the metrics are going to be, you know, some of the health outcome indicators that we know about.
Okay.
We can look at any number of measures there. There's also a number of surveys, whether it be the General Social Survey, the Census Bureau, Bureau of Labor Statistics. I mean, we got all these government agencies and others gathering statistics on the proportion of people that are covered and these sorts of things. It is hard to measure sometimes, and especially in this case, we don't know exactly how these rules are going to be implemented.
Yeah.
We don't know what the downstream effects are going to be. And in this particular case, everything that I've read suggests that most of these rule changes are going to have effects downstream about a year and a half, 2 years at the earliest.
Okay.
So Republicans will be able to get through their midterm election in 26 and not have to deal with a lot of the fallout for this. This will be something that future Congresses and future presidents are going to have to reckon with.
Right. So, Lisa, this gets this idea that the Democrats say this, you know, this legislation is immoral, and they sound an alarm. Then they're accused of, you know, really over-dramatizing something. And then, to Dave's point, for us to understand, unless you're living it, unless you have lived experience, for us to understand what happens at the macro level, we have to wait months and maybe even years to see the impact of the policy.
Correct. And I think this gets back to what Dave was talking about earlier, where there are folks who are on Medicaid who are working in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And so I think it does make us have to wait and see what essentially happens there, because I think the intent is if we get some of these folks who aren't currently working or maybe are working, but they could be working more because they are able-bodied, then that will get them off of Medicaid, and then they will be possibly eligible, depending on their situation, for either Medicaid or health insurance through their employer.
Right.
But I think that's missing the mark in terms of what types of employment opportunities may be available for some folks in rural areas.
Okay.
And possibly given some of their personal situations. You know, maybe they are working some, but they're also providing and caring for their children.
Right.
So I think some of this stuff, it kind of remains to be seen what that looks like. So for Republicans, I think they can very easily talk about what their intentions are, that, you know, we're either forcing people to be working to qualify and this is what those requirements are, versus hopefully we'll transition them into being eligible for employer health insurance. But again, like, you know, we don't know what that actually looks like. So when Democrats are sounding the alarm, Republicans can kind of come back with their intention and making it play out in a few years is something that, or more like a couple years, year and a half, you know, that's where they kind of both can be right, but it kind of helps the Republicans more than the Democrats at the moment.
Yeah.
And we should think of this from the perspective of your average middle-aged working class voter. Some of the changes here are going to be affecting their coverage. If they're working in on some kind of Medicaid benefit, it's going to be affecting the CHIP programs across the states and the way that states are funding health insurance for children. It's also going to be affecting their parents' generation. So we just have to wait and see on all this. But it, you know, in the end, everybody that pays attention to this in the public health realm is really concerned about the number of people who are going to be losing coverage.
Yeah. All right. Rural health care, we're really watching the impact of that. Are there other areas that you see that we should mention that are really worth paying attention to? Lisa, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, for me so far, looking at just, you know, who seems to be better off versus worse off with all of this. And so there's this discussion of, you know, primarily corporate America and those high income earners being better off, and then of course those who are worse off is low income Americans. And I think, again, it boils down to, will what the Republicans intend to have happen be beneficial? You know, will providing tax breaks to corporate America actually mean that there is this, you know, a trickle down effect where then they're able to create more jobs and some of these plans that they have in place will work as intended? I think, again, it's a wait and see.
Well, shouldn't we know some of that because of the Reagan era? I mean, shouldn't we have an understanding
or
of
the
whether
Bush tax cuts
exactly.
or Trump's
right.
tax cuts
yeah.
in 2017?
Well, let me ask it this way. What do we already know about the effectiveness of what I would call trickle-down economics, because I'm a child of the 80s, and that's all you heard when you were growing up in the 80s was Reaganomics?
I think Joe can answer this far better than either of us, but for the most part, that whole mythology of trickle-down economics has never really panned out. I mean, we have gone through a couple of periods now where we've lowered tax rates for folks across the board sometimes, and we don't really see this surge of economic activity. We've also seen this in other countries around the world, where they have tried, you know, using the same basic philosophy and theory that it's going to unleash economic activity, have a nicer environment for doing business, and overall revenues will go up, and it hasn't. I mean, England went through a terrible crisis with this, and that's one of the reasons why Liz Truss only lasted for 45 days or whatever her prime ministry was. We do have some experience with this, and so far we haven't really seen the kind of growth that's been promised.
I want to talk about the deficit as well, because the Congressional Budget Office has said this will increase the deficit by $3.4 trillion in 10 years or something like that. And the deficit, again, is that bathtub that's already overflowing, as Joe Santos uses the analogy about how much our debt and our deficit, the bathtub is overflowing and the faucet's still running. Mm-hmm. And that, if I've heard one thing from state political leaders about their concern, it's that they've been worried about how much the federal government is spending, and they need those cuts to happen, and that our state budget is tight and tight times are ahead, and yet here we are with another increase to the deficit to the tune of more than $3 trillion. Lisa, how will that impact South Dakotans? Because certainly our political leaders have been sounding the alarm over our federal spending since I've been here.
Right. So the federal deficit, they've had that clock running for a long time that shows how much it's increasing by. I think the biggest issue with increasing the deficit and having these various cuts in place is that it just continues to make it where state and local leaders have to make some really tough choices regarding things. And when it comes to the average South Dakotan, you know, this is what's going to continue to raise interest rates and make it hard for folks to buy cars and to buy homes and whatnot. And so I think this is where we start to see your average voter really starting to feel the effects of this legislation.
David Wiltsey is a professor of political science at South Dakota State University in Brookings. Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science, also at SDSU. You can find this conversation and more online. Search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. As part of SDPB's educational mission, let's learn more today about the U.S. Supreme Court as it impacts our lives. Professor Mike Thompson teaches at the University of Sioux Falls. He joins us to help us understand the flurry of decisions at the end of the court's current session. We'll talk here about the constitutionality of birthright citizenship, age verification laws, and LGBTQ lessons in schools. We're going to start from the beginning with birthright citizenship. But the beginning I want to start from is this idea of the federal courts and injunctions.
Yep.
Because that's really important to understand. And I'm not sure I fully understand it.
Okay. So, Trump versus CASA has gotten a lot of coverage since it first came out. And most of the coverage has dwelled on the power of the district courts to enter a certain remedy. So the background to that, there are two types of remedies in the law. They're called legal remedies and equitable remedies. Mm-hmm. So a legal remedy is generally money. An equitable remedy is an inherent power a court has to balance fairness, to balance equities, to make the situation fair. So in the United States, the court system, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court's at the top, the federal courts of appeal are in the middle, and then the district courts, the trial courts, are at the bottom. I don't mean bottom as in the worst. I mean bottom as in that's where everything starts.
Yeah, that's the front line.
That's the front line. So back in 1789, Article 3 of the Constitution says that Congress has the power to establish courts that are inferior to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Congress has the power to determine the jurisdiction of those inferior courts. So that's in Article 3 of the Constitution. So the Judiciary Act of 1789 is the act that is still on the books that sets forth the jurisdiction of the district courts. That act and also the federal rules of civil procedure and things. But so the Judiciary Act of 1789 says that U.S. courts have jurisdiction over all lawsuits in equity.
Okay.
So a preliminary injunction or any type of injunction is an equitable remedy. There's no money involved. It's just a court order saying you cannot do that anymore. I'm enjoining that. I'm stopping you from doing it. And a preliminary,
because it's not fair.
Because it's not fair. Yeah. Exactly. It's not fair. You can't do that. I think that this law violates the Constitution or whatever law it's up against. So the Supreme Court in this case goes back to that 1789 law and determines, okay, what is included in a district court's equitable powers? Oh. Is the power to enter an injunction, to enter an order stopping a law from going into effect or stopping it from being applied, is it within the district court's jurisdiction, the trial court's jurisdiction, to make that a nationwide injunction, which means it's going to cover not only, it's going to mm-hmm. stop the conduct not only of the people who are a party to the action, but it's going to stop the conduct of people who aren't parties to the action, but who are in the United States. Mm-hmm. So this is just one court in one federal court in one state stopping the application of a law, and that applies nationwide.
So this case, Trump versus CASA, this is brought by the facts of the case, some pregnant women who have said, so Trump's executive order is about birthright citizenship, and these pregnant women say this is affecting my life, and they have standing, and they bring this case, and a federal judge says, no, I'm going to halt this. There's an injunction nationwide, and that's what goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court decides what in this case?
Well, can I back up again?
Please.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it starts off as a merits case. The merits is, does the executive order violate the 14th Amendment? The 14th okay. Amendment says all persons born or naturalized are citizens.
Okay.
Persons born in the United States, naturalized, are citizens of the United States and citizens of the state in which they reside. Mm-hmm. So that's where the birthright citizenship concept comes from, or rule comes from.
So that's in the 14th Amendment, and the president's executive order says, I would like to change that?
Yeah.
Is it that simple?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. No, it's not that simple.
Okay.
The threshold issue is that's never addressed here is whether he, as the executive, even has the power to issue such an order.
Okay.
Extremely doubtful. But here we are. So he issues the executive order. The district court stops it and stops it all over. So you've got got the merits thing, which is the birthright citizenship question. Yeah. But that doesn't even make it up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay.
What makes it up is the court takes the opportunity to say, okay, we're gonna rule on whether district courts have that jurisdiction in equity to make a nationwide injunction.
Yeah.
The court says, of course, as most people know by now, the court says no. The district courts have no power to make a nationwide injunction. They do have the power to enjoin the activities of the parties before it, but they don't have
the signal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a signal, but other districts would then also say,
well,
that a case.
You're going to.
Okay, so I have a couple questions.
Okay,
so let's
good.
Go back
Excellent.
A little bit. Is this the first time this has been challenged? The Supreme Court took this case. What kind of precedent were there when they were making their decision? What was coming up in other cases?
Okay.
Because surely Donald Trump is not the first president, and these are not the first district courts to have issued nationwide injunctions.
Right. This has been happening.
Yeah.
Happening lately, when beginning with maybe the first Bush administration going up through President Trump's first term. So they've been issuing these, and what the court says in the case is, well, the Solicitor General, which is the attorney for the United States who argues in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Solicitors General have been asking us over the years to address this issue of whether district courts can issue nationwide injunctions, and we're going to take this opportunity now to decide that. We're not going to decide whether this executive order violates the 14th Amendment. We are going to decide the jurisdictional reach of the district court injunction, which leaves the birthright citizenship thing up in the air still.
So what happens to the plaintiffs in this case?
The executive order can't be enforced against the individual plaintiffs.
Okay.
Now, there are a couple of saving things here. The first thing is the states sued also. The individual plaintiffs sued, and some states sued and said, okay, now hold on a second, because states, including South Dakota, through the Department of Social Services, when they are determining eligibility for benefits, there are some federal statutes that allow the state to say, okay, you haven't been in the United States for 5 years, so you're ineligible for benefits, for example. So these states argue to the court, what are we going to do with this order in place? Yeah. We can't determine anybody's eligibility. People are moving state to state. We gotta have something that is broader than this district court's territorial jurisdiction. And so the U.S. Supreme Court says we don't have enough to determine that issue, so we're sending that back, which means that this nationwide injunction thing, all we know for sure now is that it applies only to individual plaintiffs and not to governmental plaintiffs. So it might be where the court could say, if the question comes to it again, could say states, a district court can enter a nationwide injunction that affects states, not individual plaintiffs, but states. But
we don't know that yet. That's a question mark. Yeah.
So that's that's one good thing. The second good thing is this decision is not based on the Constitution, so you don't need a constitutional amendment or a later case that overrules it to change the rule. Congress could change the Judiciary Act of 1789 and make it clear. They could also change the rules of civil procedure and make it clear that if the court in here talks about, well, you've still got the class action. The federal rules of civil procedure allow a class action. So you could get all these similarly situated plaintiffs together in one big group of plaintiffs and ask for your injunction, and the court could enter the injunction. But still, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a nationwide injunction.
Is there a decision in this? Is there an opinion, or is this a shadow docket thing? No, this is an actual, there's an opinion.
There is an opinion.
So what do you see in the opinion that gives you a hint of what their logic is in this, as they interpret this law from 1789? Yeah. Because from the beginning, you know, you've heard spokespeople for the Trump administration saying no one judge can overrule the president and make a decision for the whole country. And then the, you know, legal scholars are saying, you know, these judges are the, this is a check against executive power. And then the executive branch is saying, but it's not oversight in the executive power. What's the difference between oversight and a check and balance?
In this instance, I don't think there's a difference. Okay. I mean, the court is obviously a check on the exercise of executive power. Yeah. The only time, the only places the court kind of stands back is during war and running of penitentiaries. But they're a check on executive power. So Justice Barrett writes this opinion, and she, of course, was a law clerk for Justice Scalia. And Scalia, back decades ago, wrote an opinion about this section of the Judiciary Act of 1789 and about equity jurisdiction. So she cites that case as saying that we need a historical analog. And that's the same phrase that's being used in the Second Amendment cases. We need a historical analog from when England and the United States split that would show that a nationwide injunction at that time was part of equity jurisdiction. So it's a complicated thing. The dilemma with that, though, is the case that she talks about. And so she goes through her opinion and says, there's no historical analog here. There's no indication that this ever happened at the time of the founding. Therefore, the district courts don't have that jurisdiction.
Okay.
She gets a little snippy with Justice Jackson, and because Justice Jackson says, you have found no case that says they can't do this, that says the district courts cannot do this. And Justice Barrett says, well, now, wait a minute. The fact that nobody was doing it means that it couldn't be done, which is somewhat fallacious, an argument from silence. So I think there's obviously a lot of abrasion up there.
Ooh, there's some vocab in that.
Yeah.
The last 2 minutes of radio had some vocab. People are reaching for their dictionaries. Right?
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing.
My question is this an unprecedented time for a shift in how we view the courts? Or is it really always like this and just everybody's really paying attention because, you know, this president is something people pay hyper attention to?
I think since I got out of law school, this is the first time where there has been so much exertion of executive authority that is arguably unconstitutional. It just seems like every day there is some executive order or some action that the Constitution really sits up straight and says, well, wait a minute. And
that's intentional because the people who are doing these actions feel, I mean, they've read the Constitution and they feel like this is allowed.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And they want to test it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
They want to show that it's allowed.
The courts sit there to say, you know, no, that's the court's action. The problem with the courts is they require congressional funding to stay alive and they can't enforce their own orders. Mm. So that makes it tougher.
So we don't know about birthright citizenship yet.
No. Well,
we don't know if that executive order, can it take effect in other states? For other people?
It can. Okay. If other people want to contest it.
So then that's what has to happen.
I mean, it has to happen state by state by state. And you talk about judicial resources. Which is a valid consideration when an appellate court makes an order. What's this going to do with litigation? Well, this is going to start litigation all over the place.
Mm-hmm. What else about this case? Anything else noteworthy before we move on to a couple others?
No, I think leaving it, just know that Congress can change this result, and it's not decided yet whether litigation brought by a state can be cured with a nationwide injunction.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about Paxton, because this impacts South Dakota.
Obscenity.
Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, and back in the legislative session, we were talking with Attorney General Marty Jackley about a law in South Dakota, and everyone was watching the Paxton case.
Yeah.
And now we have an answer on the Paxton case, which is?
First Amendment case, which is that you have to show an ID to watch obscene material as an adult.
Even adults do,
even adults do.
Well, let me rephrase that. Children can't watch it, but absolutely. So everyone trying to access it.
Yeah.
Even if you have a First Amendment right to access it, you will still have to show age verification,
which
was a privacy concern for people, if you have forgotten our previous conversation.
And it's also a First Amendment problem because adults have a limited First Amendment, a peripheral First Amendment right to access obscenity, according to the court's precedents.
Peripheral, a limited.
Very limited right. Limited, right, because the court's test for obscenity has got three parts in it from the Miller case in the 1950s, and generally obscenity is entitled to no First Amendment protection. But the court's precedents have said that there is some minimal protection, First Amendment protection, for an adult's right to view obscenity. The thing that's key here is that this is related to minors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the opinion is very well reasoned. Because the court stays true to its precedents, even though the six in the majority would most likely disagree with those precedents. It does stay true to those and decides the case precedentially according to what's come before, which is a good thing. Is a good thing for me to see anyway. And if you're into scrutiny. This
do you know that
is
I am?
A bowl of Cool Whip right here, because there's all kinds of scrutiny in here.
How so?
Well, so if you have in the realm of obscenity or speech, you have content neutral laws, content specific laws, and then you have other laws that might incidentally affect a First Amendment right. So content specific is where the focus of the law is actually speech.
Okay.
So there was an earlier case, RAV versus St. Paul, that prohibited cross burning.
Okay.
And the court said that is content specific. You are regulating a type of speech. So that is subject to strict scrutiny, which means the government has to have a compelling interest for that, and the government has to figure on a narrow way, the narrowest way possible, the least restrictive means to achieve that compelling interest. The bottom line on that is most statutes subject to strict scrutiny fail. They're unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Rational basis is for content-neutral statutes. So if Minnehaha County passes an ordinance that says no nude bathing at Wall Lake, mm-hmm. that is, somebody's going to say, well, being naked is expression, and that's covered by my First Amendment right of speech. Supreme Court has said, no, those public nudity statutes are content neutral. You only get rational basis scrutiny on that, and most statutes survive rational basis. The government just has to show a reasonable relation between its regulation and what it wants to accomplish.
Okay.
And so this one sits in the middle, this incidental contact with an adult's First Amendment protection is the ID. Yeah. So in the middle like that, then it's only entitled to intermediate scrutiny, which means the government has to have a substantial interest mm-hmm. in the regulation. Mm. So you get the mind.
And in this case, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Then that interest is to protect children
right.
from exactly. exposure from to obscenity. Adult obscene content.
Right.
Right. All right, let's do one more, and that is the kids' story time.
Kids' story time.
Whether parents can pull their kids from story times and lessons in public school right. that they find is objectionable or is against their faith.
Against their faith.
That
this
matters.
Is a religious yeah. exercise.
This is a religious exercise.
Part of the First Amendment. The school... had a variety of what they termed LGBTQ+ inclusive texts in the public mm-hmm. school curriculum. And at first, the school said, okay, parents, if you don't want your child subjected to these messages, you can opt out. You can mm-hmm. pull the child. We'll let you know when we're going to use them. You can pull the child. The school board reversed this decision and said, no, you can't. It's yeah. too disruptive. It's too yeah. disruptive. And that is really, in a school, that's really a key word in First Amendment jurisprudence is yeah. it's disruptive. Because generally, if it's disrupting a classroom, the schools can regulate it, even if it's protected speech.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court went back yeah. to...
Sided with the parents.
Sided yeah. with the parents and said, no, they can take them out. They said you can. There can be an injunction here that stops the school from enforcing their rule that you can't opt out. So parents can opt out.
And we have yet to see what the implications of that are
right.
in the public school district, because that could be any number of religious conflicts on all kinds. I mean, we could just start listing things that parents might find objectionable based on their religion.
Right, right, yes. In this one, the pretty heavy precedent, it's called Wisconsin versus Yoder, mm-hmm. where Amish children, parents were criminally charged with violating the compulsory school law because they said, we're not going to send our Amish children to the public school if this is what you're going to teach about God.
Yeah.
And so they were actually charged with a crime for violating that. And the Supreme Court said, no. What's interesting... Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. But Wisconsin versus Yoder is based on the parents' fundamental right to guide their children's religious upbringing, mm-hmm. which is an odd thing for this court to rely on because it's a substantive due process protection that at least these six very much dislike. But they rely on it here and say yeah. that parents have the ability to have the fundamental right to do that. And this infringes on that right.
Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. I'm your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. We thank you for listening.